it please the court, Your Honor, my name is Daniel Reeker and I represent Mr. Arturo Barrera-Garrido regarding his post-conviction petition that he filed in Douglas County District Court. Mr. Barrera-Garrido was initially charged with felonies of false imprisonment, charged with committing a felony with a deadly weapon, and sexual assault. Ultimately, he pled no contest, counts 1 and 2, and count 3 was dismissed. The crux of the information contained in the post-conviction action that was filed against Mr. Barrera-Garrido's former counsel is that in the interim time when he was charged with those charges and the information and when he ultimately pled, was that in that time he did not receive effective assistance of counsel from his former counsel for failure to advise, investigate, look at the evidence, and more importantly, explain the evidence. In my brief, I explained each one of these individually that he talked about, but I think that when looking at the clash found in the briefs between myself and the plea, that there's two primary areas in which Mr. Barrera-Garrido's former counsel failed that I think that should have been taken into consideration by the district court, and admittedly, he should have been granted an evidentiary hearing in order to try and demonstrate that. The first and foremost deals with what specific facts were alleged in the post-conviction action. Judge in the district court, when he moved to order the case dismissed, said that there was not sufficient information to challenge or to justify the need for an evidentiary hearing. The appellee in its brief points out issues related to things such as the self-defense claim that my client attempted to assert or at least investigate through his former counsel. Now, I think that in the post-conviction petition itself, there is sufficient facts that are asserted there that should have at least warranted an evidentiary hearing.
On the self-defense?
Yes, Your Honor. Those specific facts that are asserted in both the post-conviction petition as well as in the brief are that my client had previous experiences with the victim, was his former girlfriend, a family in which he felt that he was unsafe.
So the family made him feel unsafe. Is that the basis of his self-defense?
Well, the basis of his self-defense...
Did the victim make him feel unsafe?
Not that the victim made him feel unsafe, Your Honor, but that there was other people who were involved during the time when she was involved in this romantic relationship, her other family members, some who may have been, who were present at the time, to where he was afraid that they would do something to him.
Is there an allegation the victim made him feel unsafe such that he would... have a knife?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And the problem with this is the record really scant because there wasn't additional evidence that was attempted to be found.
But that's answer to a different question. What's the allegation of self-defense?
The allegation from
that. What acts did the is there with respect to self-defense? What acts did the victim do to induce the self-defense?
Sure, it wasn't the victim that he was needed to do the self-defense from. It was he had the knife because the other family members were threatening him. Briefly alluded to in the petition, but would have been was what was hoped would have been discovered through the use of an evidentiary hearing. In addition to that, there was the knife, the weapon itself. There was allegations of who the individuals he was concerned were, that being the other family members. And this is all information that was specifically alleged.
What was the allegation that he did? What did he do with the knife?
In the allegation that was originally charged in the criminal complaint that my client's knife happened was that he used the knife to take the alleged victim into a false imprisonment situation. He claims he had the knife because in the past he threatened the family members and he was concerned of what was going to happen to him when he was at the victim's house.
What was the factual basis for the pleas?
The factual basis for the plea, Your Honor, that the state offered was that my client had arrived at the house, I believe Your Honor, had taken her into had engaged in some sort of conversation. There was a brother and a sister-in-law pregnant, Your Honor, for the alleged victim, that he had taken her to the bedroom and held the knife and held her overnight. The cops were not called ultimately until the next morning, which I guess. And that there was alleged, initially there was allegations of sexual contact that were then taken away. So there was other family members at the house when he was present there. Concerned about. So those there are sufficient facts that are pledged, sufficient to show some of the specific issues that at minimally, Your Honor, should have been determined at the use of a jury here.
Counsel, which charge are you saying the self-defense would apply to?
I believe it would have applied to the, Your Honor, to the counts one and two, which was ultimately convicted of.
How can you raise self-defense to a false imprisonment charge? If you're falsely imprisoning somebody else, how do you imprison them to defend yourself?
Well, Your Honor, he was concerned that other family members might do something to him, so he's saying he had the knife, Your Honor. That's why ultimately the police found the knife. He's not saying that he used the knife to take her into the room or anything like that. He's obviously saying that didn't happen, Your Honor. He's saying that he had the knife when he was there because he was afraid that the family members were going to use it. Not that he falsely imprisoned her.
The knife doesn't become an active crime until he uses it, does it?
Sure, Your Honor.
I mean, if he had the knife, that wouldn't be a crime necessarily, but when he pulls the knife out and threatens the victim with it, then that becomes a crime.
That's true, Your Honor.
Now, how is that self-defense?
Because, Your Honor, he would have been able to assert self-defense because his position would have been that other members of the family, and again, this is briefly alleged to in the petition, was that other members of the family were going to do something to him. And that's why he needed to have the knife, and that's why he had it in the first place.
Well, having the knife is totally different than what you do with it.
That's true, Your Honor.
Maybe you should move on to something else.
Sure, Your Honor. In addition, so our position, Your Honor, is that there was sufficient allegations in the petition to minimally request an evidentiary hearing. There's other issues related to what was actually advised, which leads me to the second part of this, Your Honor, and that being that my client was unadvised about multiple aspects along the way, and the way in which the district court attempts to deal with that, which is alleged in the appellee's brief as well, is that the judge advised him of things that were necessary to show whether or not he could enter his plea knowingly, intelligently, voluntarily. And what my client's position is that when the court, we're not challenging, as it happened in the Armitage case, Your Honor, we're not challenging that what the court said was sufficient. We're saying that what his counsel didn't do was insufficient and that the court's advisement was too little too late at that point.
What was the status of your client with regard to his literacy of English?
He did not speak English, Your Honor. He only spoke Spanish. So
was there an interpreter there?
There was an interpreter.
So it would be the interpreter that was telling him what the judge was saying, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. But again, we're not saying that what the judge was saying was wrong. We're saying that the fact that his attorney failed to advise him before he got to the point is the problem, that the court's advisement doesn't cure the defects of his counsel's ineffective assistant before he got to that point.
And what specifically did your client's earlier lawyer leave out?
Sure, Your Honor. He did not explain to my client what the evidence was according to his allegations and his complaint, that he did not have the police reports read to him, that he didn't even know that there was a deposition taken, let alone what was said in that deposition, what the general's ability for him to be successful trying to assert something at trial, or what the trying to make the state prove its case would have been. He had none of that information pursuant to his petition prior to walking into the courtroom. Now, the argument that the state or that the judge in the district court made was, well, I advised him, that's what I'm supposed to do. He understood my advisement, that's sufficient. I don't think that's sufficient. That defense counsel has a responsibility and an ethical duty to properly advise before you ever walk in there. And if your counsel does not do that, then you can't enter your plea knowingly and intelligently. We refer to the Padilla v. Kentucky case in the brief, not to say that this says immigration has nothing to do this, but what the footnote contained in that case dealt with, Your Honor. That the court saying what counsel does is more important, or at least as important as what the judge does to help an individual be advised. That's why that footnote in that case that we referred to talks about the fact that Kentucky and other states, including this state, have, even though the judge has a responsibility to advise, defense counsel has to advise before you get there.
Did the defendant understand that there was some type of a plea agreement in which one of the charges was being dismissed?
When I initially talked to him, Your Honor, he said he did not. That's why in the petition he said there was no plea agreement. In addition, there was, in the record, some inconsistency with the order about whether or not there was a plea agreement. View of the record showed that there was a plea agreement, but my client didn't understand that. I think that's another example of his attorney's failure to advise him before he got it.
So you're saying that at the plea, the advisements of the court cannot cure a prior failure to communicate. Is that your position?
That's my position.
And you're relying on Padilla for that?
I think that's a corollary, similar case to it, Your Honor. My position would be that we have these ethical guidelines as defense attorneys, advise our client, private client, or for example, and that if you don't do that before you get to the courtroom, the court's advisement in itself is not enough to.
Did your client ask for any time to step back and speak with his attorney about what was being said on the record?
He did not at that time, Your Honor. He didn't ask for it.
Didn't they say, we've entered into a plea agreement, we're going to plead guilty counts 1 and 2 and dismiss count 3? Was that on the record in front of the defendant?
That was on the record in front of the defendant, yes, Your Honor.
And so at any time, did the defendant ask his attorney about what's going on, or can I have more time to speak with you about this, or anything like that?
He did not, Your Honor. That it would appear, at least from, I don't want to infer something that's not a record, but it would appear that he didn't understand what was going on, even a year after the petition was filed. So,
do you have any other developmental disabilities that prevented from understanding?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. The only problem that he had at the, or the only, it's not a disability, but he didn't speak English, but there was an interpreter, Your Honor. It was just,
there's no allegations, the interpreter wasn't accurately interpreting.
I see that I'm out of time, Your Honors. We'd ask that the court reverse and remand this case to the district court for an evidentiary hearing. Consistent with.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Marfisi, good morning.
Sarah Marfisi, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Nebraska. The defendant alleges that his pleas were the result of ineffective assistance of counsel. However, all of his claims fail the prejudice prong of the Washington v. Strickland test. No evidentiary hearing is required if the record affirmatively shows that the movement is entitled to no relief, or if the motion contains insufficient factual allegations to demonstrate prejudice.
Now, under this particular issue in front of us, he would have to show that but for counsel's ineffective assistance, he would not have pled and would have insisted on going to trial.
Yes, Your Honor. And he's failed to do so in his motion.
He didn't allege that in post-conviction.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
He didn't allege that in post-conviction?
He only conclusorily alleges that he would not have pled and would have gone to trial. That sentence appears page 17 and 18 of the transcript. He makes that statement, but he doesn't have significant factual allegations that show a reasonable probability, given the evidence and the benefit of the plea agreement, that he would have risked trial. I'd like to start with the defendant's claim that his counsel failed to advise him about the charges or the nature of the plea agreement. The record affirmatively refutes any claim of prejudice from this argument, because the district court explained the charges and the scope of the plea deal at the plea hearing. Even if defendant's counsel had given insufficient explanations, the defendant can show no prejudice because the record demonstrates that he understood the charges and the scope of the plea deal before entering his plea.
I think that opposing counsel is suggesting that a failure, if failure there be, can't be cured by the court.
Your Honor, I don't believe that that's supported by case law. On a post-conviction motion, he has to show prejudice, and he cannot do that given that he was informed by the district court. Padilla versus Kentucky does not help the defendant. That case holds that defense counsel must advise of immigration consequences. However, it does not reach the issue of prejudice. There's no indication in that case as to whether the district court actually advised that defendant as to the immigration consequences or whether he was prejudiced. And prejudice is the key issue here. Here, because the record affirmatively shows there's no prejudice because the court carefully explained all of the charges, the existence of the plea agreement, he repeatedly stated that he understood and did not need more time to talk to his counsel. Therefore, the defendant is entitled to no relief on that claim. The remainder of the defendant's claims have insufficient factual allegations of prejudice to merit an evidentiary hearing. Motion must contain more than a self-serving allegation that the defendant would proceed to trial. Must also contain objective evidence that establishes a reasonable probability that the defendant would have risked trial.
Well, what more objective evidence can you have than the defendant said, but I'd known what I was going to get, or what had been my counsel properly been effective in representing me, I would have gone to trial. What else can he say?
Well, in this case, on post-conviction, as this court said in State versus Abdul Qadir, post-conviction motion must contain factual allegations actually amounting to prejudice. And that's what's lacking in the remainder of the claims. The defendant's second argument is that his counsel failed to investigate or present the defense of self-defense, but he does not explain who the alleged other witnesses were who would have established the self-defense, nor does he explain how self-defense can be a defense to false imprisonment, sexual assault, use of a weapon to commit a felony. This is insufficiently pled. Similarly, he argues that his counsel failed to advise him regarding depositions, police reports, or other physical records, but he does not explain what was contained in these depositions, reports, or records, how they would be helpful to his case, why those records would have caused him to risk trial. And there was significant evidence against him that makes him unlikely that he would have risked trial in this case. In this case, the defendant held his ex-girlfriend at knife point overnight, threatened to kill her or her family if she left him. The victim's sister, the victim's brother-in-law, and Omaha police officers the next day all observed the defendant holding the victim at knife point. Police recovered the knife that the defendant brandished, and he received significant benefit from the plea agreement because the state dropped a Class 2 felony charge. Given the significant evidence and the lack of specific allegations in his motion, he cannot demonstrate a reasonable probability that he would have risked trial. The district court did not err in denying him an evidentiary hearing. Similarly, any claim of prejudice on his first argument is affirmatively refuted by the record. For these reasons, the state would ask this court to affirm the order of the district court.
Is this right? Your view is that all of these issues can be decided either by reference to the petition or the record could be refuted by the record. Is that your position?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I believe there's no time for rebuttal. Is that correct?
That's correct.
There is no time for rebuttal. We will go on to the next case of the day, which is Strohmeyer versus Papillion Family Medicine, P.C.